Okay, thank you very much for coming to hear the answer to the question, why me? Sometimes it happens in your life that things go wrong and you say, why me? Sometimes you lose your money on the stock market. You think, why me? Sometimes your husband runs off with another woman. You think, why me? Sometimes your kids don't behave. You say, why me? Today I'm going to give you the answer to that question and other questions which you don't ask about why me. It's the law of karma. That law of karma is a law of justice, of fairness. It's a law which makes sense of some of the things which happen to us in life. Because really, we should never say, why me? The answer to that question, why me, in brief, is, why not? It's got to happen to somebody, and usually you have been responsible somewhere for making that happen. The wonderful teaching of the law of karma is that we're all responsible for our actions. Many years ago, when I was a young man, I think I must have been 19, 20 years of age, I went to India to see some of the holy places. But also, I went up to Kashmir to see the beautiful valley of Srinagar. In those days, the only way you could get to Srinagar, the Kashmir Valley, was to go overland from, what was it, Jammu, I think. It was in the north of India. So I got on the bus with a lot of other young people and also other Indians travelling into Srinagar. In those days, it was only a single track road. It was unpaved. It was gravel and full of potholes. And that vehicle, that bus, went very, very fast. Up these mountain roads, round these hairpin bends. On one side of the bus was a vertical cliff going upwards. On the other side of the bus was a vertical drop going downwards. This was up in the mountains, in a single track road, on a gravel track, going way too fast. Every now and again we'd look over the side to the drop, and there we'd see the wrecks of many buses just like ours. It was dangerous, and so with many other travellers there, we asked the driver, can you slow down? Take it easy. If something has come in the opposite direction, or there's a boulder fallen down, we would not be able to stop in time. And all the driver would say, the driver was a Muslim, he said, if it was Allah's will, we go over, it's Allah's will. That didn't really help all the non-Muslims in that bus. But I started thinking afterwards that really, if that was, say, a Christian driver, he may actually say the same. He may say, it's God's will, we go over. If it was a Hindu, they may say it's the law of karma that we go over. And I wondered what a Buddhist would say if that vehicle, if that bus, because of going too fast, crashed and went over the edge. A Buddhist would say, it's not Allah's will. It's not God's will. It's not the law of karma. It's because of a stupid driver. Now that's the law of karma. We go over because the driver was going too fast. You see, the law of karma is not something which is just being made in some past life, which determines what happens to you in this life. Karma is being made in every moment. In that particular case, it would be going over the edge because the bad karma of that driver by driving too fast. So when we look at the law of karma, it's something very different than fatalism. Because some people sometimes ask me this question, this law of karma, does that mean that the future is destined? Is karma the same as fatalism, that you're destined to come to this talk this evening, and you had no choice? Is this in your stars that you had to join this retreat? Is the future all mapped out for you? And I'll tell you about the future. Many people think that monks can tell the future. Because of that, they ask you to please, monk, tell me my fortune. If you can't tell me my fortune, at least you can tell me which horse is going to win in the races the next day. Now, some people believe that. And one of the stories I tell about fortune telling, I told one of those stories last night about the five angels. This is another story about fortune telling. This young man, well, not young man, so this old villager, came up to see my teacher Ajahn Chah once. He came up to see him to ask Ajahn Chah to tell his fortune. Monks usually don't tell fortunes, not good monks. But this man reminded Ajahn Chah of all the service he'd given in the past, how he'd helped build the monastery, how he'd given so many donations. And this was the least Ajahn Chah, this monk, could do to a person who'd helped him so much. Out of gratitude, at least, he could tell this villager's fortune. And the villager was sure Ajahn Chah had the power to know the future. Ajahn Chah kept on saying, "No, I can't do this." But this man was so insistent, eventually Ajahn Chah gave in. He told this man, "Give me your palm. I will read the fortune from the lines on your palm." The man was pleased and excited. This was the first time such a great master had ever done this for anybody. Not only was he special, this villager, but he also knew that Ajahn Chah would never lie, would never make a mistake. Whatever Ajahn Chah said this man's fortune would be, it was sure to turn out to be true. So he was very excited when Ajahn Chah started tracing the lines on this man's palm with his index finger. Ajahn Chah stared in deep concentration at the lines on this man's palm, and every now and again Ajahn Chah would stop and say something like, "Ooh, that's interesting. My goodness, look at that. Ooh, what do you expect?" And this man, because of Ajahn Chah's words, was getting very, very excited. Imagine a great master, one who never makes mistakes, about to tell your future. Wouldn't you be excited? This man certainly was. He couldn't wait for Ajahn Chah to finish. When Ajahn Chah did finish, he looked in Ajahn Chah's eyes and said, "Well, what is it? What's my future going to be?" And very slowly, with the calm of a meditating monk, Ajahn Chah said, "Sir, your future..." "Yes, get on with it," said the man. "Your future..." "And I never make a mistake," said Ajahn Chah. "Yes, I know that. Please let me know what my future is." "Sir, your future is uncertain." And Ajahn Chah was absolutely correct. He never makes a mistake. What he was doing was using that occasion to teach the Dharma, to teach the truth to somebody who would not listen if you just said that out loud. "No one can tell the future. The future is uncertain." He used that as an exercise to make it very clear that no one can predict the future, because we're always interfering with the progress, the passage into the future. We're always making karma. We're always changing the direction of our journey. Because we're always making karma, that's why the future will always be uncertain. So if anyone ever asks you, especially you yogis who've gone on this retreat, "What have you learned from this retreat?" you can tell them, "I've learned to predict the future." And for a donation to Mahinda Rama Sunday School, you can ask and predict your future, you can say. "What is my future?" they say. "Here's ₹5 to give to charity." You say, "Your future, sir or madam, is uncertain." Which is why I tell Chinese people like trying to find this future. One other saying which I have is, never trust a poor fortune teller. So because we're always making karma, that's why the karma is not fatalistic. We are always interfering with what happens, which means that what we've got to deal with, the ingredients of our life in this moment, that is what we've made, what we've built up, what we've constructed with our deeds of body, speech and mind. This is what we've got to deal with. My old simile for the law of karma in the Buddhist understanding is a simile of the two ladies baking a cake. Two ladies baking a cake. The first lady has the very best of ingredients. The second lady has got the worst of ingredients. The lady with the best of ingredients has got this... So let's start with the worst of ingredients first. The lady with the worst of ingredients has got this old white flour. Old white flour with green bits of mould in the middle of it. They've got to take out that mould so they can use the white flour which remains. They've got hard fruit, which is hard as bullets. They've got butter full of cholesterol and sugar full of poison to actually make their cake. And their kitchen is just so old, it's pre-World War, that is World War I, not World War II. They've got the very worst of ingredients to make their cake. That's woman number one. Woman number two has got the very best of ingredients. They've got organically grown whole wheat flour. It came from a place where there's no GM crops for 100 miles around. It's perfect, it's pure. They have, instead of butter full of cholesterol, they've got this wonderful canola oil, rapeseed oil, which is supposed to be cholesterol free. In place of this hard fruit, they've got this amazing succulent fruit, fresh from Penang. And honey, they've got honey from Western Australia. I'm biased. And they've got an amazing state-of-the-art kitchen. They've got the very best of ingredients. That's woman number two. To understand the law of karma, I'm going to ask you, of those two women, the one with the worst ingredients, the one with the best of ingredients, which woman bakes the most delicious cake? Which woman bakes the most delicious cake? It is not always the woman with the best ingredients. Because it's not just the ingredients make for the delicious cake, it's what you do with those ingredients. The amount of care, love, skill, energy you put in to baking that cake. Some women are so skillful. They put so much care and love into what they're doing. With the very worst of ingredients, they can make the most delicious cake. Some other women are lazy. They're not caring. They don't put effort into what they're doing. With the best of ingredients, their cake is not tasty at all. In baking a cake, it's not just the ingredients, it's what you do with them, which is most important. That is the same with life. With life, you have the ingredients of your life. The wealth of your family, your intelligence, your beauty, what happens to you in life. That's the ingredients which you have to work with. Some people's parents aren't that rich. Some people aren't particularly beautiful or intelligent. They haven't got very good ingredients to work with in their life. Is that their bad karma to always suffer as a result? No. The ingredients do not make the cake. It's how you put them together is the most important. So if you have poor ingredients of your life, you may not be the most beautiful girl in Penang. You may not be from the richest family in Penang. You may not be the most intelligent boy at school. But it doesn't matter. It's what you do with those ingredients makes you a success or a failure. And the law of karma says because we're making karma in every moment, no matter what we've got to deal with, we can always make a good cake, no matter what the ingredients, as long as we put in skill, care and effort. The trouble is that sometimes when people have good karma from the past, good ingredients from the past, their parents are wealthy, they're beautiful, they're skilled, whatever they do, they seem to succeed. Those people with good ingredients can very often become heedless, can become lazy. One of my friends at university at Cambridge, a close friend, I went to school with him, we went to Cambridge together, he was doing medicine, brilliant man, until he started taking heroin. That was the end of his medical career. He became an addict. He was caught stealing not only from his friends, but from the medical cabinet to the hospital. That was the end of his career. That was a person I knew personally who had wonderful ingredients for his cake, but did not know how to put them together. He had good karma from the past, but didn't make use of it. I know other people who haven't been the most beautiful, the most intelligent, they haven't come from rich families, but my goodness, they've worked hard. They've worked hard with skill, with energy, with persistence. They've made such good karma in this life that they are successful, they are happy, they are well respected. Let's take an example of that. If you take a survey of many people in the world, of people they respect, high on that list will be Nelson Mandela, a person who did not come from a wealthy family, a person who is even sent to jail, not particularly beautiful, rich, or even intelligent. But he made so much, not good at school I'm talking about, he made such great use of the ingredients of his life that he became a person that the world looks up to. It doesn't really matter if you're born in poverty. It doesn't matter if you're not good at school. It doesn't matter if you're not beautiful. It's what you're doing with that is what really counts. This is a karma which we make in the present. What that tells us is that we're not destined to always be unhappy in life. What it means is that our future happiness or our suffering is very much in our hands right now. It gives us the freedom to find happiness. And it also tells us that if we get unhappiness or pain, we've got no one to blame except ourselves. Too often in our world, if we find unhappiness, if we suffer, if things go wrong, too often we always look for someone to blame. It's her fault. It's his fault. It's my child's fault. It's my parents' fault. It's the government's fault. We always tend to blame others. Are you a person who blames others for your misfortunes in life? If you are, in Ajahn Chah's famous words, you are a person who has an itch on their head, but only scratches their bottom. If a person has an itch on their head and scratches their bottom, does the itch on their head go away? No. In fact, they get two itches for the price of one. If you have an itch on the head, where should you scratch? On the head. If it's your suffering, if you blame other people, you are scratching in the wrong place. So if anyone ever blames you, and you know they are a Buddhist, they've come to listen to Ajahn Brahm's Dhamma talks, you should tell them, you're scratching your bottom when your head is itching, you're scratching in the wrong place, husband, it's not my fault. If you're suffering, it's your fault. Because when we scratch in the wrong place, the itch never goes away. If you blame other people, you get double suffering. Your suffering remains, and you make other people suffer. You make more bad karma. So remember, if there's a problem in your life, stop blaming other people. Stop even blaming yourself. Blame doesn't solve the problem. In Buddhism, we have acknowledging that we made a mistake. Forgiving means we don't punish ourselves. Learning means we use that experience to grow, to never do the same mistake again. The Buddha said that's growth in Buddhism. When we understand this, we understand what the law of karma is. We don't solve bad karma problems by making more bad karma. It's sometimes what happens to us. We are suffering, we are hurting. And what happens when we're suffering, when we're hurting? We usually want to go and hurt somebody else. That's called anger. How many times when you've been angry, it's because you have been hurting. You want to take it out on somebody else. Look, if you won the state lottery of Malaysia this evening, if you suddenly found out you were a multi-millionaire, could you get angry this evening? Could you get upset if somebody leaving this place, they, on taking their car out, they scratch your car? Would you ever get upset if your husband didn't make the dinner for you when you get back, or your kids came late? You'd be so happy. I've won the lottery. If you're happy, you find you just cannot get angry. If you're miserable, if you're suffering, if you're ill, how easy it is to be grumpy and to be angry. If you look carefully from your own experience, you find that you get angry at others only when you are hurting. So you know, if your husband or wife gets angry at you, it can only mean that they are suffering. So if you go home from this retreat and your wife starts to scold you and starts to call you names, look at her and say, oh, you poor thing. Oh, you must be hurting so much. So give her a good hug every time she scolds you. Then you're understanding where anger is coming from and how anger is solved. You don't solve bad karma by making more bad karma. That just adds fuel to the fire. Someone scolds you and you scold them back. Tit for tat. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. That just makes more business for dentists and opticians. That's not the way of solving the problem. So instead, we give forgiveness. We make good karma whenever there's bad karma. Wherever we are receiving the fruits of some bad karma from the past, we never make more bad karma. We accept, forgive, and learn. We make use of it. Bad karma, as I was saying yesterday, is like receiving a pile of dog poo. You know what dog poo is? Have you ever stepped in dog poo? That's what life sometimes is like, stepping in dog poo. If you step in dog poo, people get very upset. They say, why me? It's because you weren't looking where you were going. It was there, you should have seen it. It's your fault. It's not the dog's fault. That's what dogs have to do. It's not up to them. Sorry. Okay. It's not up to the dog. It's up to your feet. Now, this is what Ajahn Chah used to say to us Westerners. Whenever we were walking barefoot, we were always stubbing our toes or stepping into things. He said, you Westerners have got stupid feet. So what was he actually saying? It's your fault. No one else's fault. So when it's your fault, acknowledge, forgive, and learn. Because dog poo is very, very useful. When you dig in dog poo around your mango tree, your mangoes become even sweeter and more delicious than the house next door. And when you taste your mangoes, remember where that delicious taste came from. It came from the poo. And this simile means that the law of karma is, whenever you get dog poo, stop complaining, pick it up, and dig it in. Dig it into your life. Acknowledge, forgive, learn. from the adversities of life, if we learn from the adversities of life, then no matter what the ingredients of our life, no matter what the misfortunes, no matter what happens to us, we always make use of it. We learn. We grow. So this is actually understanding what the law of karma is always about. It's active. When someone comes up to me and tells me their problems, you know, they never come up to me and tell me their successes. They never come up and say, oh, Ajahn Brahm, I'm so happy. Things are going well. My wife loves me. My children are doing well. I'm becoming very rich. My business is going well. I'm very happy. They never come and say that to me. They only come and say, oh, my wife is arguing with me. My children are being awful. My parents are arguing with me. My business is going bust. I've got cancers. I've got this. I've got that. They always come and complain to monks. And that's what we are. Monks are dustbins. That's what Ajahn Chah said. When you become a monk, you become a dustbin. People come up and they never put their good things in there. They put the good things in a donation box, but they put all the rubbish into you. But he said, when you're a kind, compassionate person, you should have a very, very big dustbin. So such a huge dustbin, I can accept everything which you give to me. But, he said, always be a dustbin with a hole in the bottom. So you never keep anything. So but what we're saying is here that sometimes when people come and complain about their misfortunes in life, sometimes when they ask me, sometimes I'm very to the point. I tell them, yeah, so what? What are you doing about it? They say, my wife has run away, she wants a divorce. Yeah, what are you doing about it? My children are in trouble with the police. Yeah, what are you doing about it? My business has gone bust. Yeah, what are you going to do about it? I've got cancer. What are you going to do about it? I'm not sure if you heard that story of the man. He went to see the doctor. He had cancer. The doctor said, you've only got 1 month to live. The man replied, doctor, I do not think I can pay your bill in 1 month. Okay, I'll give you 2 months to live then, said the doctor. Business is business after all. So, if you've got cancer, whatever's happening, what are you doing about it? So instead of complaining, that beautiful Chinese saying, instead of complaining about darkness, you can always light a candle. So, no matter what the results of your past karma are, if you're suffering, if there's problems in your life, if there's difficulties, you'd never get much sympathy from me. But you get encouragement. What are you doing about this? There's always something you can do, no matter what you're experiencing. Something you can learn. The smelliest dog poo makes the most delicious mangoes. So what we're doing here, we're using the bad karma of our life, the bad ingredients, and we're getting in there and making a beautiful cake out of it. So that's encouraging each one of you. Even if you made some so-called bad karma, they think, what can I do with this bad karma? It's going to hurt me. I've got to pay back for all the cruelty and difficulty which I've caused others. Oh, this is going to be awful. Oh, this is going to be terrible. I tell them the beautiful story of the Buddha. You cannot undo bad karma. Like this story, there was a man who said some terrible, terrible words to his wife. He really called her some awful names, and he was so upset about it afterwards, he came to see the monk. He said, monk, I've really made some bad karma. What I've said to my wife, I shouldn't have said to anybody. How can I make amends? And the monk was very wise. He said, I'll let you do a ceremony. To be able to make amends for what you said, I want you to go to the market and buy a chicken. We need the chicken to perform this special Theravada Buddhist ceremony. Do you know the Buddhist ceremony in Theravada to undo bad karma? was the ceremony of the chicken. So this man went to the market, he bought a chicken, a dead chicken, brought it back to the monk. Now what do I do? And he said, now take this chicken home. On the way home, pluck out all of its feathers and throw them by the side of the road. In the morning, come back and bring the chicken with you. He said, what's that going to do? And the monk said, just follow instructions. So, he plucked the chicken on the way home, put the chicken in the refrigerator overnight, and in the morning, took the plucked chicken to the monk. He said, now what do I do? And the monk said, now, you've got this plucked chicken. I want you to walk on the same route you went home last night. Pick up all of those feathers and put them in the same place in the chicken where they were before. And he said, look, I probably won't be able to find those feathers. It was last night I dropped them off. They'd probably been blown away or somebody's taken them away. And how can I put them back in the same place? Ah, said the monk. Plucking out feathers and throwing them away and then trying to catch them again and put them back in the same place. It's like trying to... There we go. That was a chicken. Trying to put them back in the same place is like catching the words which have come out of your mouth and trying to put them all back again into the same place. You can't do that. Once the words leave your mouth, you can never catch them and put them back in. And the man understood that there is no ceremony to undo the bad effects of speech. Once out of the mouth, you can never catch them and put them back in, can you? Well, that's what happened with the chicken story. Once you pluck the feathers, you can never put them back in. So understanding this, you have to be very careful with what you say. But nevertheless, the Buddha said another way which you cannot get rid of the bad karma of your past, but you can dilute it. What he said was that, using the famous simile of the spoon of salt, he said, if I get a spoon of salt and I put it in this cup of water, and if I stir it all up, this water will be so salty I would not be able to drink it. However, if I take the same amount of salt and put it, say, in a swimming pool and stir all that up, then I probably would not even be able to taste the salt. It will be so diluted. And the Buddha said, it's the same as someone who's committed some bad karma. If they've only got a little bit of good karma, then the mixture you can hardly taste, you can hardly drink. It's so unpleasant, it's so hard to bear. But if you have that bad karma and you dilute it with lots and lots of good karma, then the same amount of bad karma you would hardly be able to taste. So if anyone has done some bad karma, you better start diluting it quick by making lots and lots of good karma. And that's what happens. So what we're doing there, we're using the bad karma we've made, and instead of complaining about it or thinking, oh, this is going to hurt, this is going to hurt, this is going to hurt, we're making lots of good karma to dilute it. Whatever you've done and whatever you've experienced, there's always something you can do. And making good karma, again, is a creation of our happiness for the future. It's a creation of happiness even in our present. Sometimes people ask, well, what actually is good karma? Good karma is what makes you happy now and creates happiness in the future. Good karma is generosity. Because when you make generosity, you feel good about it. Before I was a monk, when I had money, I was very generous. The few times when I was generous, I always remember. For example, once, at the Buddhist Society in Cambridge, a Tibetan nun came to give a talk, She was running an orphanage in the north of India. This was in 1969, I believe. And I was so... It wasn't an inspiring talk as far as the teachings of the Buddha, but this was a kind lady doing something good. And I was so impressed and inspired. The following morning, just on a whim, I went to my bank and I took out £10 and I sent it by a bank draft to her orphanage. £10 might not seem much to you, but to a student in 1969, that was 2 weeks' food money for me. I never starved, but I did go hungry for those 2 weeks. I never had as much food as I should do, because I gave it to an orphanage. That was the best £10 I've ever spent in my life. I get so much happiness out of that now, as I did the last 35 years, I think. 34 years. Almost 35 years. Give a couple of weeks, it's 35. It made me so happy. I learned that that was the instant result of karma. But you don't get it just instantly, you get it time and time again. A good act is like sowing a mango seed. From one mango, from one seed, you get a whole tree of mangoes year after year. One good act multiplies again and again and again. That's the law of karma. Unfortunately, it works the other way as well. One bad act does not come back to you without interest. It comes back many, many, many times over. And that's why we should never do anything which is unkind, but always do things which are kind. The other time, I'm not sure if you can appreciate this, but when I was young, I had a motorbike. I used to go around on a big motorbike. But when I decided to become a monk, I realized monks and motorbikes don't mix. Imagine riding a motorbike with this road. Once the wind got in the road, you'd be flying off. So I had to get rid of my motorbike. But of course, I didn't need any money for it. You don't need money when you're a monk. Everything is provided for you. So I didn't know what to do with my motorbike. Fortunately, a friend of my mother's was interested in getting a motorbike. So we made an arrangement. He came down to my mother's flat where the motorbike was. I took him downstairs to have a look at it. He liked it. He said, "How much do you want for it?" I said, "Let's go upstairs to settle up." And he went upstairs to my mother's flat because I wanted my mother around to help me. When we got up in front of my mother, I asked him again, "Do you want the motorbike?" He said, "Yes, how much?" And with great joy I said, "If you want that motorbike, you can have it, no charge, for free." And I always remember him turning around to my mother with a look which said, "Is he all right? Is he crazy? Is he mad?" And my mother, obviously knowing me, said, "Yes, yes, yes, he's not crazy, he's not out of his mind. It was an expensive motorbike," but she told that friend that I was becoming a monk. I didn't need money. And so I gave him that expensive motorbike for free. Later on, my mother told me how much that gift meant to that man. It was the first time anybody had ever given him something expensive for free. My little act of dana had made a person appreciate what generosity is all about. Perhaps the greatest act of generosity I have seen was not people who have given checks for thousands of dollars. When I was a monk in Thailand, I was cleaning out our hall one day. It was my job to sweep the main hall. I was sweeping behind a cupboard when I heard somebody creep in. At first I thought it was a thief, because the way they crept in, they obviously did not want to be seen. So, being cautious, I just peeked around the cupboard. It was not a thief coming into the monastery. It was a young girl who I knew from the village had a mental illness. She had been born without her full faculties. She could not speak. She could not go to school. She was demented or whatever it is. I wondered why she was creeping in. Then I saw her go up to the shrine in front of the big Buddha statue, quickly place something there, do three very, very rapid bows, and run out. And of course, after she'd run out, I wanted to find what she placed on the shrine. I went up there, and I saw there was a paper lotus. She'd folded a piece of paper to try and make a lotus flower as her gift to the Buddha. It was ugly. It was not beautiful at all. She was not mentally competent. She was not intelligent. She was not skilled. It was an ugly old piece of paper coloured with crayons and folded, which made it look half like a lotus. But I realised what it had taken for her to make that little lotus flower. How much effort and care. She'd crept in because she obviously thought if a monk saw her, they would stop her. That no one would allow such an ugly object to go in front of the Buddha. But knowing how much it meant to her, how much effort it had taken for her to both make that creep in and put it in front of the Buddha, to me that was the best dana offering I'd ever seen, to this day. When I saw the other monks, I stood up and said, "Monks, if anyone moves that flower, they're going to have me to deal with." That was a great gift, not because of its beauty, not because of its intrinsic value, but because the effort which it took for that mentally disabled girl to put it there. It's the effort which makes it beautiful, not the amount. It's the care, the love, what you put into these things makes it good karma. So those acts of generosity which I've seen in my life are beautiful acts of good karma. They create happiness. They create beauty in the world. They inspire us. But even more than that, keeping precepts is a great act of good karma. When we keep precepts, and sometimes we ask people to keep the 5 precepts. Recently in Thailand, people were keeping the 5 precepts, putting their hands up in Anjali. And we saw them putting one finger down, like this. I just show people. We couldn't figure out what they meant. Why weren't they putting all the fingers out in the proper attitude of respect? Why were they bending one finger down? We found out afterwards that if you put one finger down like that, you still chant the 5 precepts, but it means you're only keeping 4 of them. And once I saw that, I saw some people with 2 fingers down. I saw some people pronouncing the 5 precepts with all their fingers down. They were just saying the words, but not following the principles. And so these days, because some people find it difficult to count to 5 when it comes to precepts, I usually teach people just the 2 precepts. If you can't keep the 5 precepts, at least you can keep the 2 precepts. You know what those 2 precepts are? Not doing anything which hurts another being. That's precept number 1. And precept number 2, not doing anything which hurts yourself. Those are the 2 Buddhist precepts. Can you keep those precepts? If you keep those precepts, how can you kill living beings? How can you steal? How can you commit adultery, which hurts your partner so much and hurts you? How can you lie, which hurts? How can you take alcohol and drugs, which hurt you? If you can keep those 2 precepts, you can keep all the precepts of the world. You can't even scold your husband or wife. That's hurting somebody. So if you can't keep the 5 precepts, keep the 2 precepts. And if you keep those 2 precepts, doesn't it make sense? You're not hurting anybody. You're not hurting yourself. Doesn't that create happiness? That is creating good karma. You're creating happiness in the world by being good. Some years ago, I was teaching a retreat in Australia. It was in a Catholic retreat center. just between interviews, I looked out of the window. It was a Sunday. The Sunday service in the nearby church was just finishing. I saw two men who had been in the church together, who were saying goodbye to each other, two friends. One of them, as they were parted, said, "Be good." The other one said, "No, I won't, that's no fun." And I thought about that. How many people in our world think that being good is no fun, and being naughty is where all the happiness lies? Ask yourself, if you want a good time, what should you do? Obviously, it's rational. If you want a good time, then be good. Good people have good times. This monk sitting here is a good time monk. I'm a good time monk. Do you want to have a good time? Then be good. That's not such a joke, because if you do good, you create happiness. Keeping precepts, making good karma, gives you instant happiness here and now. You know how I learnt to keep the five precepts? When I became a Buddhist, I never knew anything about those five precepts. No one ever taught it to me. I'd learned meditation first. Now, as I was meditating, it just did not seem right. It didn't make common sense to kill living beings. I even became a vegetarian. I always remember just at university and college, all my friends called me a rabbit, because that's how I was eating rabbit food. But I countered by saying, "Well, what are rabbits famous for?" They would shout down for vegetarian food, the vegetarians here, and I'd call all my friends carnivores. And the reason I did that, because I didn't feel good about eating meat. I didn't know why. I stopped stealing. I wouldn't really steal, but if I went on a bus and no one asked me for the fare, I thought, well, that's okay, I won't pay. But I didn't feel good about that. It didn't seem right. I don't know why. I couldn't even do that anymore. I had to pay, even if it wasn't asked. When it came to being true to my girlfriends, I would always be true. I would never commit adultery. It didn't seem right to hurt someone who you were having a relationship with. And even lying, I couldn't lie anymore. When it came to alcohol and, well, drugs, I wasn't interested in drugs, but alcohol. A student in the late 60s who were into alcohol with your friends in the bars. When I gave up alcohol, I thought I was giving up because I couldn't see the purpose in it. I was poor as a student, and you wasted all this money on beer and alcohol. What did you do that for? Even dogs don't drink alcohol. But when I gave it up, I thought, this is going to be tough. I thought, once I give up alcohol, I will not be invited to any parties ever again. But I found the opposite is true. If you do good karma, you always get great benefits afterwards. I got invited to even more parties than before. When I became teetotaler, I wouldn't have alcohol, I got invited to all sorts of parties. You know why? Because they wanted somebody sober to drive them home afterwards. So that was me. There are great advantages for giving up alcohol. So I gave up breaking precepts simply because of the logic behind it, the rationality behind it. I always remember going to a Thai temple in London. And these monks came up to me one day. One of the monks said, "You've been coming to this temple long enough. It's about time you took the five precepts." I always enjoy telling this tale. And I said, "Venerable sir," I said, "what are the five precepts?" And he said, "Not killing, not stealing, not committing adultery, not lying, not taking alcohol or drugs." With a smile, I said, "Venerable sir, I've been keeping those for a year or two now. I don't need to take them." That's how I learned to keep the precepts. I learned to do them out of common sense, out of being a rational person, about wanting happiness in life, wanting to give happiness to others. It just didn't make sense to me to create harm in the world. those two precepts, hurting another person, hurting oneself, that's the core of all of the precepts. I didn't invent those two precepts. That came from the Buddha in his advice to his son Rahula, the Rahulavada Sutta. You can see that there. The core of morality is doing good for the sake of happiness, yours and other beings. So this, you can understand what is good karma. Not hurting others, not hurting yourself. Isn't that a sensible thing to do, to create happiness in your life, not hurt? But it works in an even more deeper way than that. Once you start to do good, help others, you get happiness back in so many unexpected ways. Recently, I found out about an old friend I'd known many years ago. This was an old monk who was with me for several years in Thailand. It's been over 20 years since I left Thailand to live in Australia. Many of those monks I lost contact with. Even though this monk was an Australian monk, he disrobed and went to live in Sydney, and I never heard of him again until 6 months ago. He had been a builder monk. He had given up about a year of his meditation time to build a hut for Ajahn Chah at the time when he became sick. When Ajahn Chah entered his sick period, an ordinary hut was not really conducive for his well-being. So this monk designed and built, laying the bricks, doing many other the work himself for his teacher Ajahn Chah. It was an enormous sacrifice of many hours of long work for the space of about a year. And if you ever go to Ajahn Chah's monastery, you'll see that we call it the Clinic Kuti, or it's called the Payaban Kuti, where Ajahn Chah spent his last years. That monk built that hut with his own hands. The reason why we got in contact with him again was 6 months ago. He went to visit Wat Pa Phong, Ajahn Chah's monastery, to give a large donation, because a month or two before, he had won the first prize on the Australian lottery, the big one. And he realized that the karmic cause of him winning that lottery was the great gift he'd given to his teacher. It's a beautiful story of what happens if you give from the heart. At the end of the retreat in KL, one of the retreatants there had just come back from India. He had dropped his business, he was a developer, to actually to go on a pilgrimage to the holy sites of India. Before he left, he signed a contract with a builder to build a condominium somewhere in KL. When he came back, the first telephone call he received was from the builder, who said, "I can give you a 40,000 ringgit discount." Without even asking for it, 40,000 ringgit fell into his hands. I know another young man who was working in the hospitality industry in New Zealand on one of the ski resorts. He had a wonderful job with a free apartment, a free car, and a very, very good salary. One of the Thai monks of our tradition visited him in New Zealand. After looking after him for a day or two, this young man decided it wasn't right to allow this senior Thai monk to return to Bangkok on his own. Because sometimes Thai monks can't speak Thai. This actually happened to one of our monks recently. One of the Thai monks in Perth recently. We were taking him to the airport in Perth to send him back to Bangkok. He'd actually checked in. We were taking him to the departure lounge, to the gate where you enter. He couldn't speak any English, nor could he read English. Fortunately, at the last minute, one of the monks looked at his boarding pass. His boarding on the plane going to Saudi Arabia. The stupid person at the check-in counter had pressed the wrong button and gave him a seat on another plane going in the opposite direction to the capital of the Muslim world.
I don't know what would have happened to him. Imagine arriving in Saudi Arabia as a time monk, not being able to speak any English, let alone Arabic. Those things sometimes happen. So, this young man, so a Thai New Zealander, decided he'd have to accompany this Thai monk on his journey back to Bangkok. So he rang up his boss, can I take a day or 2 days off work just to accompany this monk to Bangkok, I'll come straight back. The boss said, no, you can't go, I need you. And this young man said, look, this is really important to me, this is my master, this is my religion. I'll only be a couple of days, and I'll come back and I'll work extra for you. And the boss the second time said, no. So this man said, okay, I'm resigning. I have to take this monk, I don't care about the job, the car, the apartment. So he resigned on the spot. Took that monk back to Bangkok, spent an extra week in Thailand. When he came back to New Zealand, he told me that his girlfriend really, really scolded him. You stupid boy. He had a New Zealand girlfriend. You're stupid. You'll never get another job like this. You should be practical. Religious teachings are fine, but you have to live in the real world. And of course, after 1 week in Bangkok, when he came back, the first day, he picked up his phone, called a contact. They had a job, bigger car, bigger apartment, and his salary was increased by something 30 to 40%. That's always the result of good karma. I've never known yet anybody who's done a good deed who has never been rewarded immediately and many times for the rest of their life, let alone a future life. So that's why it's not just learning how to deal with the bad karma of life, it's learning how to deal with the good karma of life. If these things happen to you, you deserve it. If happiness, good fortune, good luck, wealth, whatever comes, then don't think that, oh, this is just good fortune. You've worked for that. So when bad things happen, we have to look for the cause. What do we do? Somewhere along the line we've done something. If happiness comes, what do? If, you know, good fortune comes, wealth comes, happiness in your marriage, you've done something there, you deserve that. If you have good children, you've deserved that. What have you done for that? You have to have been a good person, a kind person, a generous person. Find the causes of happiness and repeat them. Find the causes of suffering and do not do them ever again. What you're doing is learning the laws of life, the law of cause and effect, the law of karma. And if you learn that law of karma, then you'll understand how to be in control of your happiness. It's true that you can't predict the future, but you can say, if you make good karma, you're going to be happy. If you make bad karma, you're going to be in pain. It doesn't matter whether you get caught or not, whether somebody sees you or not, you know that you've done something bad. And you can also apply that to others. If other people have hurt you, if they mistreated you, if they cheated you, always remember that they've done bad karma. If they've done bad karma, the suffering will come to them without you getting involved. You do not need to punish them. You know that they're going to get hurt, they're going to be in pain somewhere. So you do not need to get angry at people who have hurt you. If you're a Christian, then God will punish them. If you're a Muslim, then Allah will sort it out. If you're a Hindu, karma will get them. A Buddhist, karma will come out. Even if you're an atheist, if you don't believe in any religion, you will know if they've done a bad thing, then they'll have to go into therapy for many years. Either way, you don't get away with anything in life, nor do you fail to get rewarded for any goodness which you do. The universe is fair. Sometimes when we think it's unfair, it's only because we haven't got the big picture. Most of our ideas of injustice are just perceptions, misperceptions of injustice. If we could only see the big picture over many, many lives, we could probably see, yes, there is some cause, there is some effect there. For example, many people ask that question, the Twin Towers bombings. How come so many people died in those Twin Towers bombings? Were they all really innocent victims? Many people make karma together. All the people on this retreat are making good karma together. Sometimes people, they join in gangs and they rob, or sometimes they rape, they kill in gangs. Sometimes troops of soldiers, many soldiers together do terrible deeds. If we do the terrible deeds together, sometimes we receive the fruits together as well. Maybe it is the case that those people who died in the Twin Towers were maybe part of some army in the past, some troops who raised and killed many people in a village. They did the karma together, they received the fruits together. Very often, this is what happens. So sometimes we ask, is there such a thing in life as an innocent victim? It might seem that way, but when we see the big picture, there's not such a thing as an innocent victim, nor is there a thing as somebody who gets away without being punished, without recompense for any misdeed. In the big picture, it always comes round. Fairness and justice. So knowing that, if you want to be happy, if you want a good time, then be good. Thank you. Very good. Now we have the fun time. Questions. It must be, I don't know if it's something good I've done in the past or bad I've done in the past, but it must be something that I have to answer all these questions.
Yeah.
I've got some questions on pieces of paper here, which were any of the retreatants here, if you want to ask some questions. It doesn't have to be on the talk of tonight. It can be on previous talks. I have some of these questions here. So I'll do these questions while I'm waiting for any more questions to come up. The first question is the meditation question. After a certain period of practice when we may develop some concentration, how do we use it for vipassana? Do we need a primary object for vipassana? Vipassana is insight meditation. Concentration, they say, is samatha meditation. There is no difference between the two. When you are concentrated, when you are peaceful, then you see things as they really are. You don't need to switch from one thing to another. I gave the simile yesterday of going up the hill to my monastery. The slower you go, the more you see. When you stop, you can see the hillside fully. You get insight into what's there in the hillside only when you slow down and you stop. It's like a person going up a mountain. Some people go up the top of the mountain for the wonderful view. Other people go up to the mountain because it's peaceful up there. It's away from the noise of the town, the city. If a person goes up there for the peace on top of the mountain, they're going to see the view as well. If they go up there for the view, they are going to experience the peace. Which is why the Buddha said there is no difference between vipassana and samatha. They're just two parts of the same thing. There is not a vipassana way of meditation. There is not a samatha way of meditation. Both are the same. For those of you who don't believe this, I was going to bring this up this evening, but I thought, no, I'll talk about mindfulness tomorrow morning. And while I was in the library in interviews, I just grabbed a copy of the Majjhima Nikaya on the 118th Sutta, which is called Anapanasati Sutta. The Buddha says, and I'll read this out tomorrow, just so you know that I'm not making this up, by fulfilling Anapanasati, you fulfill the four foundations of mindfulness. Now look, think about that. By fulfilling Anapanasati, you fulfill the four foundations of mindfulness. You're saying by doing Anapanasati, you are fulfilling Satipatthana practice. People say Satipatthana is Vipassana. People say Anapanasati is Samatha. If that's what you say, the Buddha is saying, by fulfilling Samatha, you're fulfilling Vipassana. And he goes on to say, by fulfilling the Satipatthana, you fulfill the seven enlightenment factors. By fulfilling the seven enlightenment factors, you fulfill right knowledge and liberation. In other words, there's no difference there. So, the meditation you're doing here is called Satipatthana meditation, because you're watching your breath. Are you confused? Now I'm saying what the Buddha said. Remember yesterday I said if there's any controversy, if there's any confusion, if there's any argument on the soccer pitch, who should you ask? The referee. And who's the referee? The Buddha. So ask the referee, and that's the referee's decision. I will read that out tomorrow morning for you. So you don't need to stop to do Vipassana. Carry on doing your Anapanasati. That was what the Buddha used under the Bodhi tree to get full enlightenment. Anapanasati is a complete path in and of itself. You don't need to do it as a preliminary. It goes all the way. Any questions about that? Okay, I'll talk about that again in more detail tomorrow morning, coming up. For those who've got good karma to be on this retreat, if you've got bad karma, you have to go to work tomorrow, then try and do more goodness in your next lifetime. You may be able to come on a retreat. How to share this rightful teaching to someone who has a strong self-view and yet an ambitious, business-minded person? You have to use psychology. You have to tell a person that if you're a business person and you want to achieve things in life, then be a Buddhist. Because Buddhists have the competitive edge. It's true. In business, you are so serene. When other people get anxious and make wrong decisions, you're really peaceful. If you can develop your meditation, you may even be able to read the minds of your competitors. Wouldn't that be good? So, if you're really ambitious, then you should be a Buddhist. If you want to be the wealthiest person in the world, then be a Buddhist. Who is the wealthiest person in the world? Is it Bill Gates? Is it the owner of Walmart in America? Is it Sultan of Brunei? Who is the wealthiest people in the world? Why do I say that? Because good monks don't need anything. When you've got everything you ever want, aren't you the wealthiest person in the world? Has Mr. Bill Gates got everything he wants? Or does he still want some more? The greatest wealth is contentment, said the Buddha. You're so content you don't want anything anymore. That's why you don't have to work anymore. You can rest, you can enjoy yourself. You can retire. Do you want to be so wealthy you can retire? I retired at 23. And I have always had enough to eat, a place to sleep at night. I said, I think yesterday, that this brown robe is like the best gold credit card you can have. This is gold. It's like having the gold express card. Unlimited credit. I can go to any monastery and get unlimited food. This is what it's like. Any place in the world. I can go and have a room for the night. I can have food and breakfast. I can have people looking after me so well. As a monk, I live 5-star accommodation. Sometimes as a young monk, it was 1,000-star. You'd live out under the stars in the forest. How much better accommodation can you get than that? So this is if someone has a strong self-view and ambitious, then be a Buddhist. In Chinese, there is a belief that death, one will return after 7 days of dying. Is this true? Oh, to visit someone you love. So you're saying, there's a Chinese saying that after 7 days you will return to visit you, to someone you love. If you really love them, would you go and visit them? You know they'd be scared stiff. They'd be terrified of your ghost. Isn't it funny? It may be someone you love. It may be your old dad or your mother. You love them so much in this life. You weren't afraid of them when they were alive. But once they were ghosts, you're terrified of them. When they were old and very weak and sick, they couldn't do anything. As a ghost, they can't do anything either. You don't need to be terrified of ghosts. Ghosts have never harmed a human being. Never. When I was at university, one of the societies I belonged to was the Psychic Research Society. The College Society was run by a professor called Tony Cornell. He's still a friend of mine. I just got a card from one of my university friends. I just had dinner with him. He's just retired. He's 80 years of age now. He was the one who was on the board of the Ghost Hunting Council of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. That was on his business card. It's a wonderful business card to hand out to people. He was a ghost hunter, one of the professionals. Throughout my monastic life, every now and again in the Sunday papers, you would see some ghost haunting in England. He'd be the one writing the article. He was a personal friend, still is. He told me, and he continues to say, he's been in many houses in Britain. There's lots of ghosts in England. They're famous for it. There have been lots of ghosts. He said there have been lots and lots of ghosts, lots of hauntings. He's got amazing stories to tell. But never once in the hundreds of years that professors have been investigating ghosts in England has anyone ever been hurt. He said sometimes there have been bottles of water being flying through the air just past his ear. There have been eggs that have been going over his head and smashing into the wall. But a strange thing, they never hit. It's not that ghosts are bad shots. It's just that the law of nature is that ghosts cannot hurt you. All they can do is make you afraid if you've got no wisdom. If you've got wisdom, you know that ghosts really are afraid of you. I don't get scared. I make ghosts scared. That's why monks are the best ghostbusters in the world. Did I tell you the story of the gypsy girl? Was that yesterday? How long ago was that? Because I tell so many talks, I don't know what I said yesterday and what I said a week ago in KL. I tell the story anyway. That once, I was visiting my mother in London. She was making my meal for the day, my dana, my food. And that was important. I didn't want her to be disturbed, otherwise I would miss my meal. So, when her doorbell went, I volunteered to answer it, so she could carry on cooking. When I answered the door, there was a gypsy girl in front of the door, a gypsy woman. In London, the gypsies go door to door selling trinkets to try and make some money. These are worthless things which city people buy. Instead of getting a proper job, that's what these gypsies would do for a living. So when this gypsy said, I'm a gypsy, do you want to buy some gypsy flowers? I said, no thank you, I was polite. But then she looked at me and said, if you don't buy these, I will put a gypsy curse on you. That's what they used, that was their marketing technique. If you didn't buy their goods, they would put a gypsy curse on you. And many superstitious people, not believing, you know, what gypsies could do or what they couldn't do, would actually buy those things just in case. But as for me, when she said, if you don't buy these, I'll put a gypsy curse on you, I said, if you're going to do that to me, I'm going to do something to you. I stood up in my robes and said, listen, lady, I am a Buddhist monk, and my curses are much more powerful than your ones. The colour drained from her face. She turned around quickly and she ran away. Serve her right. So sometimes I can be cheeky like that. So, the idea of your relations returning in 7 days. If you want them to, you can invite them. If you don't, you can say, don't come. Sometimes it happens, but it is quite rare. Very rare, in fact, that anyone sees a ghost. Okay, let's have a show of hands. Hands up if any of you have actually seen a ghost. One. Two. Okay, very good. That's usually about half the course. Usually about 1 in 100 people, on average, have seen a ghost. I do that in Australia, in Sydney, Melbourne. Ask who's seen a ghost. If you've seen a ghost, those two put your hand up. Was it frightening? Usually it's not. Sometimes they see a ghost and just looks like an ordinary person. But strange. It's only afterwards they sometimes feel afraid. When they realise, my goodness, I've just seen a ghost. How many of you have seen the bottle ghost? That's what I said last night, the bottle ghost. Next question. Here you go. The practice of Buddhism emphasises on three things. Be good, do good, and purify the mind. If I am not interested in devotional practices, does that make my practice incomplete? I was never interested in devotional practices to begin with, but I found out that those devotional practices are part of purifying the mind. Do you do devotional practices to your wife? Say how much you love her and care for her? Give her presents on her birthday? Show how devoted you are to her? If you don't, your marriage is in trouble. Do you do devotional services to your husband? Give him a hug, give him a kiss, look after him when he's tired. Try and cook the food he likes. If you don't, again, your marriage might be in trouble. That reminds me of a story I meant to tell about karma. Oops. And actually, how we can take control of our destiny. Because this actually story was told to me in Singapore by a marriage guidance counsellor. One of her clients came up once to her and said, that my husband is staying out late at night, he comes home late, he says he's been in the office, but I do not believe him. I think he's going out partying or to karaoke bars, I don't know who he's seeing, but he's not at all affectionate towards me, I think our marriage is in trouble. And then the marriage guidance counselor said, well, if you really like that, then you should divorce him. And she said, no, that will make him happy. So, the marriage guidance counsel was very, very smart. She said, okay, if you don't want to divorce him now because it'll make him happy, try this plan. When he comes home at night, make sure that you smarten up your appearance. Go to like a good hairdresser and do up your hair. Even go to a beautician and do something about your complexion. Get some new clothes. Wear some makeup. Be extra kind to your husband. Be charming to him. Because if you're like that, there's a good chance that he may start to like you again. In fact, if you keep on doing this plan, there's a good chance he might fall in love with you again. Now, once he's fallen in love with you, then you can divorce him. And she said, yes, yes, that's a good plan. So they did this marriage guidance counselor and this wife. She started, you know, beautifying herself up, making some nice meals for her husband, being kind, being charming. And every sort of couple of weeks, the marriage guidance counselor would ring her up and say, what's happened? Ask this lady what was happening. And they'd get a report, a progress report. And she said, actually, it's beginning to work. She's starting to come home early. And he's actually being more friendly towards me. I'm spending a lot of money sort of tidying myself, you know, up, getting some nice dresses and nice perfume. He's coming home earlier. Great, keep it up. And over the weeks, he started coming back earlier and earlier, being more and more affectionate. And then, this woman stopped ringing up her marriage guidance counselor, giving progress reports. So after a month, the marriage guidance counselor rang her up and said, how's it going? I said, it's going tremendously well. He comes home as early as he can from the office. He's so affectionate, he's so kind. I think he's actually falling in love with me again. Great, said the marriage counselor, now we can get divorced. He said, oh no, he's so nice, we're having such a wonderful time now. And that's how she saved their marriage. That was her plan all the time. Really, you can get your marriage back on track if you put in the effort and the care, can't you? Law of karma, there's always something you can do with what you've got. Next question here. Is the world a reflection of the consciousness? Aha. You make the world, not the world makes you. This is an interesting question. Are you happy now? Put your hands up if you're happy. You miserable lot. Only three people are happy. Come on, put your hands up if you're happy. Right up. Keep them up if you're happy. Now, with your index finger, those of you who put your hand up, can you please now point to that happiness for me? Point to it. Where is it? Locate it. Why can't you do that? Were you imagining that happiness? Was it real? Why can't you locate it in space? The reason is, happiness doesn't belong to your body. Happiness belongs to your mind. This is my party trick to prove the existence of the mind, that the mind has nothing to do with your brain or your body. If the mind was in your brain, you would say, I'm happy. You'd be able to say when you are angry that I'm angry. You'd be able to say when you're depressed, my brain is depressed. Why can't you say that? Because these things do not live in the body, they live in the mind. To give a fuller explanation of what I mean. Actually, that same friend who was in the Psychic Research Society with me. So this is not Tony Cornell, this is the friend who was a common friend of the two of us. He joined the diplomatic service. He was a British diplomat after Cambridge. He had two daughters. He always keeps in touch. He told me that when his first eldest daughter went to primary school, the teacher asked one morning, what is the biggest thing in the world? One of the five-year-old children said, my daddy. Another child said, an elephant is the biggest thing in the world. They've just been to the zoo. Another child said, a mountain is the biggest thing in the world. They were getting better. But the daughter of my friend said, my eye, E-Y-E, is the biggest thing in the world. And even the teacher stopped, what do you mean by that? And this little five-year-old philosopher said, well, my eye can see her daddy. My eye can also see an elephant, and it can see a mountain and much more as well. If all of that can fit into my eye must be the biggest thing in the world. That came from a five-year-old. Isn't that wise? But it's not quite true. Because your mind can see everything which your eye can see, it can also imagine things you'll never be able to see in the real world. Your mind can also hear sound, can also imagine feelings And it has its own sphere of thoughts and impressions as well. In fact, everything which you can experience can fit into your mind. So isn't your mind the biggest thing in the whole world? Isn't it the case that the world is not a reflection of consciousness? The world is contained in your mind. That is why when I asked, are you happy, you couldn't point to it. Because happiness is in the mind, not in the body. And the body and all space is in your mind. When you are happy, the universe is happy. Your universe is happy. That's when you're happy. When you laugh, the whole world laughs with you. When you're in grief, the whole world is sad. The world is in you. You are not in the world. The mind is the forerunner of all things, the chief, the number one. And I have just proved it to you. So is the world a reflection of the consciousness? No, the world is in the consciousness. They said, if yes, is it fair to say that the world is unreal, like a dream, since consciousness is not substantial, unreal, not self? I think I've answered that question. The whole world is in your mind. The mind is the forerunner, the chief. So if you purify your mind, you are purifying the whole world. Next question. In Malaysia, we have the death penalty. Hey? No, like this. If we see a drug pusher selling drugs, do we report him to the police? If we do, are we responsible for his death? In Malaysia, we have the death penalty. If we don't, we are allowing him to harm people. What should you do? Okay, that's one of those really difficult questions, and I love difficult questions. If you see a drug dealer, and if you report him to the police, if you know that he's going to get the death penalty, what should you do? Of course, one of the best things to do is to try some alternative ways before you report him to the police, if at all possible. For example, you can give him a CD of Ajahn Brahm's talks. Or you could warn him, if at all possible. But sometimes we have duties to be done. And sometimes if those duties are reporting him to the police, we're not doing that to kill. We're doing that to perform our duties. We're doing that to stop him killing others. We don't know whether there will be eventually death penalty or what. The point is, it's like when we're sweeping a path. It's what our intention is. If that path has got ants on that path, but we're sweeping, not intending to kill those ants. We're trying our very best to avoid killing those ants, but we're sweeping to make the path clean. Then, because our intention is not to kill, if by accident we kill, then there's no offense at all. We're not breaking our precepts. In the same way, if you come to Mahindarama Temple on a Sunday evening to hear the talk, but you know that coming in your car that many insects will go splat on your windscreen, is that breaking your precepts? If you did that, you'd never be able to go anywhere. You don't drive your car with the intention of splattering insects. You drive your car with the intention of coming to hear a Dhamma talk, or going to work, or going to see your parents, or whatever. The intention is paramount. If your intention is pure, it's never breaking precepts. It's not bad karma. The Buddha said that intention is karma. Chetanahang kamang vadami. Chetana, intention I say, is karma. So when you're doing that, if you're about to report a drug dealer, you have to ask yourself, why am I doing this? What is the main reason am I doing this? Am I doing this in order to have that person killed? Is it out of real ill will? Or is it out of some form of compassion, some form of duty? If it's out of compassion, out of duty, not out of ill will, then there's no bad karma for you. If you're doing that because you don't like that person, maybe you've got a grudge against him, now's your opportunity to pay him back, then that is bad karma. Check out your intention. Why are you doing that? Does that make sense? You see, intention is paramount. Why? Next question here. Oh, it's the same one. Oops. That's okay, I've answered that one. Ajahn Brahmawangsa, so when we are practicing samadhi and experiencing physical body pain, do we note it, just like vipassana meditation, or not? How do we curb the pain? Please advise. I told all the people here that during this retreat, we are not practicing anapana sati. Anapana sati is different than anapana sati. Anapana sati is meditation on the breath. Anapana sati is meditation on pain. The Buddha never taught anapana sati. So, if you have pain when you're meditating, to make sure that you're not slack and heedless, try this procedure, which I do. If I'm, say, watching my breath, and then I get a pain in my knees, I ignore it and go back to my meditation object, the breath. If it comes up a second time, I ignore it a second time. Just because we do things in Buddhism three times, bow three times, three refuges, it's all three times, I ignore it a third time as well. Having ignored it a third time, no, tutiyampi, tatiyampi, third time. If it comes up again and grabs my attention, then I give up my breath and take the pain as my object of meditation. With kindness, with acceptance, saying, pain, the door of my heart's open to you. With peace, being content to be at pain. I try to develop peace with pain. I never make war against pain. I make peace with pain. Buddhism is pacifist. Make peace, not war, is my motto. Is that what you do? Or do you make war? Get out of here, pain. Struggle with pain. Fight pain. Try and conquer pain. Just like the US Marines. You never get peace that way. So, and I look at the pain, make that the object of my meditation, but sometimes it happens, very often. The looking at that pain, it gets so bad, I can't stand it any longer. I want to move. The first time that thought comes up, I want to move. I ignore it. Dutiyampi, tatiyampi, three times, I ignore it and stay with the pain. But the fourth time it comes up, then I move. I change my posture. I've endured enough. That's enough. That's called middle way. Because you will find, you meditators, if you keep sitting through pain, if you try and struggle through pain, psychologically you will associate meditation with suffering. You'll look upon the meditation retreats as coming to suffering. You'll tense up before you come here, just like you tense up before going to see the dentist. Coming to the temple will be even worse than going to the dentist. In a dentist, you're in and out in half an hour. You come here, and it takes 9 days before you can go home. Psychologically, you'll not be opening your mind to meditation. You'll be resisting, bracing yourself against pain. After a while, you will give up meditation. No one will keep going for pain again and again and again. It makes no sense. However, if you follow this path of happiness, which is what the Buddha expected you to do, you come to a meditation retreat and you have a happy time. You enjoy this time. My goodness, you're paying enough for it. Are you paying enough just to suffer? Or do you expect some happiness for all of the energy and time and effort which you put into this retreat? If you develop happiness, not only will your mind incline again and again to meditation, but you'll go home more relaxed, more at peace, ready to face the world. I've told everyone on this retreat is not a suffering retreat. This retreat What's it called? Club Med Penang. Club Meditation Penang. You're in a temple. You spent all day in this monastery. This is a holy place. So you've had a holy day. A holiday. This is 9 days of holidays. Holy days. Practicing meditation. Surely a holy day should be fun. You've had the feast at lunchtime and at breakfast. This is a holy day. This is Club Med. You enjoy it. How do you think I've been a monk for over 29 years? Do you think anyone could endure 29 years of suffering and pain, sore knees, aching heads? No way. If I hadn't got some happiness out of this pretty quick, I'd have gone back into the world. The only way that you stay as a monk is because of happiness. You enjoy this lifestyle. You've all seen me long enough. Many of you know me for many years. I'm happy monk. I enjoy myself. I smile. I tell jokes. I'm relaxed. That's what happens to you when you meditate. You become light-hearted. You become light. That's what enlightenment means. Becoming light, unheavy. And really, if you finish this meditation retreat, and you're all stressed out and in pain, you are not a good advertisement for Theravada Buddhism. If you go and tell your Christian friends, what are you doing in this retreat? Endure pain, pain, pain. They're never going to convert to being a Buddhist. But if you go and say you had the most happiest of times in your life, you became so peaceful, you experienced so much bliss, that you experienced a pleasure which is greater than sexual intercourse, then even the Christians are going to come here. And many others as well. And that's what happens if you follow these instructions. The path of meditation is not a path of pain. The path of meditation is a path of abandoning suffering, not of accumulating suffering. Letting go leads to peace. Peace leads to happiness. And most importantly, happiness leads to wisdom. Sukhino chitang samadhi yati samadhi pachaya yata bhutayana dasana. Not in one place in the suttas, many, many, many places. The Buddha said this. From happiness, you get stillness, samadhi. From stillness, you see things as they truly are. Wisdom, insight. From happiness to stillness, from stillness to wisdom. The Buddha never said, dukkha patayā samādhi. From pain you get stillness. Have you ever seen anyone in pain being still? I think I make my point. The Buddha made his point. If you want insight, if you want wisdom, you need stillness, you need happiness. That's where people get enlightened. I think I made my point. I can quote sutra after sutra after sutra, time and time again. Ajahn Chah was the happiest person I've ever seen. That's why he had good meditation. That's why he was enlightened. I am very interested to know about heavenly beings, especially Sakadeva Raja. Tell me more about them, e.g. Sakadeva Raja. Heavenly beings. Has any of you ever seen a heavenly being? I'll tell you a story of a heavenly being. You know this story about, this is one of the amazing, wonderful stories, a modern story which is so similar to what happened in the time of the Buddha. One of the monks I know, who is still a monk, he's a friend. Many years ago, he was, I think, doing peace work in Thailand. He decided he wanted to try being a monk. He did not know what to do. He was an American. That's all the indication I'm going to give. He was an American. He went into a hotel in Bangkok. He asked the concierge or whatever, I want to become a monk, how do you do it? And the man said, well, a lot of Western monks become monks in the temple called Wat Pho Won in the center of Bangkok. He said, what you should do is go there early in the morning, take some food, wait for the monks to come out on alms round. Give some food to one of those monks, and then ask them, I want to be a monk, please help me. He said, that's what you should do. Now, that's not what I would advise, but that's the advice he was given. So he got some food, got in a taxi very early in the morning, and arrived outside the gates of Wat Pho Won in the center of Bangkok. However, he got the times very, very wrong. He arrived there about 4 o'clock in the morning. It was so dark, all the gates were locked, there was nobody around. He walked up and down, wondering what to do next, looking for somebody to ask. Soon, a man, a well-dressed man in traditional Thai clothes, came up to him and asked him what he wanted. The Thai man spoke perfect English. He said that he wanted to become a monk. He said he was told to bring some food, but he got the time wrong. The man said, don't worry, I can help you. The monks will not be coming out for at least an hour and a half. While you're waiting, I can show you around the temple. And taking out some keys, he opened a gate, a big iron gate, which led in to the monastery of Wat Pho Won. Having opened the gate, he got out some more keys and opened the main door of the main Upasaka Hall. This is the Holy of Holies, where they do the ordination ceremonies in Wat Pho Won. He then turned on the lights and proceeded to explain to this young Westerner all the paintings inside the temple wall. You know, Wat Pho Won is the royal temple where the King of Thailand was ordained temporarily, where the prince was ordained, where all the royalty get temporary ordinations. And those paintings on this big temple in Bangkok were very complex, and it took a long time to actually explain what each of these figures meant. And this man was a wealth of information, explaining what the paintings meant, but also where the paintings came from, who donated them, who sponsored them. The young American said it was fascinating to hear all this detail. And when the hour and a quarter or so was finished, the man, the Thai man, said, well, the monks are going to come out in a few minutes' time. He pointed to where this young man can stand and pointed out a monk who would come out who would be able to help him be a monk. So the young American went to stand while the Thai man turned off the lights and closed up. It happened exactly as this Thai man said. After a few minutes, a senior monk came out to where this Westerner was standing. The Westerner put some food into this monk's bowl and asked, can I become a monk? I want to be a monk. And the senior monk took him and started training him to becoming a Buddhist monk. However, this young American was assigned a Thai monk to train him, whose English wasn't all that fluent. And after 3 or 4 days, this American was being frustrated, because he really couldn't understand what this Thai monk was trying to say. So he asked the Thai monk, said, isn't there somebody else who speaks better English than you? To explain all the procedures and what I'm supposed to do. And this Thai monk said, no, this, you know, I'm as good as anyone here. And then he said, what about that temple attendant who I met on my first day here? The one who had the keys and opened up. And at that, the monk said, what temple attendant? And this young American described that he was met outside the gates of Wat Pho Won at 4 o'clock in the morning. And this man produced a set of keys and opened this gate. The monk stopped. I know that gate. That gate has not been opened for at least 60 or 70 years. He immediately took that monk, or that young American, to see the abbot of Wat Bhawan, who is now the Sangharaja of Thailand. He started telling his story to the Sangharaja. I don't think it was Sangharaja at this time, he was just the abbot or Somdet at the time. He started telling the tale. The Sangharaja stopped him, called for his secretary, and asked him to begin again. Because that gate has not been open for 60, 70 years. I know that gate very well. Those who've been to Thailand who know that monastery know just opposite the road is the bookshop, the Mahamakut bookshop. That gate is directly between the bookshop and the main temple. It's locked. It's always been locked. Also, no layman has got the keys to the main Upasana hall. That's kept with two senior monks. Thirdly, you can't turn on the lights there. The light switch is a completely different place. Fourthly, not even the Sangharaja of Thailand, one of the oldest of monks in that monastery, knew all the details of those paintings and who sponsored them. These were things which were completely impossible. When they asked him, who was that man? They asked to describe him. This young man looked around and saw the man on the wall. His picture was there on the wall. King Rama V, the king of Thailand who sponsored and built Wat Bhawan. That is a true story. The story of an ex-king of Thailand who as a deva, a heavenly being, saw a young Westerner, obviously with many, many, much, much good karma, who wanted to become a monk, and helped him become a monk. Open doors which have been locked for 60 years. Turn on lights which can't be turned on there. And explain things which only a person who built that temple would ever know. In the suttas you hear tales of Sakha, the deva, opening the gate of the town for Yasa to go out to join the Buddha, one of the first disciples of the Buddha. You hear tales of devas helping monks in times of need. This was a modern tale of a deva helping a young American become a monk. Isn't that good? Next question. When bad things happen to us, we often blame it on our bad karma. My question is, how are we supposed to deal with the fruition of bad karma without creating another bad karma? Yeah, I've already told you that. The bad karma is dog poo. You've stepped in dog poo. You're smelly, terrible time. What are you going to do about it? Dig it in. Don't make more bad karma. No matter what ingredients you've got to work with, you can always use it to make good karma. Acknowledge, forgive, learn. Next question. My husband killed in an accident, left behind the expecting wife. Is it the past karma object to... Is it the bad karma effect to both the husband and wife? The surviving widow wished to know, is her life predestined? Okay. The husband was killed in an accident, left behind an expecting wife. Now, is it the husband's karma that he had an accident? Sometimes he could have been drinking while driving, could have been using his mobile phone when he should have been paying attention. He could have been talking to his passenger. It could be the karma, the immediate karma just before the accident. Not necessarily predestined to die when he was young like that. We're always making karma every moment. So sometimes it could have been due to a previous life, but it could also be due to heedlessness a few minutes before he crashed the car. When it's the expecting wife, is it her karma as well? It could have been her karma to have to deal with a child just without a husband. So, the point is, we cannot really know whether it was the karma of the moment, the karma of this life, or the karma of the past life, but all we do is to say, well, there it is. What are you going to do about that? Instead of pining and grieving for the person who's left, who has no longer there, it's obviously a good thing for the wife to immediately, as soon as possible, come to terms with her grief. So saying last night, you can look upon life as a concert. What a wonderful time she had with her husband. The husband has left her with a child, something which she would always remember her husband by. A child from him, a child from her, the wonderful gift of their union together. So she has something of her husband left in that child. So she's not completely deserted by her husband. So now she has something there to honor, respect with gratitude the memory of her husband, to acknowledge, to forgive, and to learn from the experience. So she can become a better person to look after that young child. We have family, we have friends, she may be even to marry again, who knows. But now her karma is to work hard for the benefit of that child. And there's no reason why not. That experience can be like the dog poo to make an even more sweet mango of her life. Even though it is a difficult ingredient to make a good cake out of, it is not impossible to make a good cake out of that. I mentioned to many people that my father died when I was 16. My mother was left without a husband with two young children, teenage children, in the difficult times of their life. I say this because I am the son of my mother. That was one of the best things which ever happened to her as far as her spiritual life was concerned. Under my father was always the most dominant part, was a dominant partner of that relationship. But once my father died, my mother had to grow and take responsibility. She did very well. She became a much better person as a result. Obviously, it wasn't pleasant for her, but she took that challenge on board and grew out of it. Sometimes when these things happen, we can make a wonderful cake out of those experiences. So that's my answer. Whoever that woman is, don't grieve about the past. Don't carry the coffins of the past on your head, because it means you can't face a future. You can't work hard in the present to make a good future for yourself and the child. That's what you should be doing. Two more questions and then we finish off. Two questions here. Question. Always we hear say, if we protect Sasana, Sasana will protect us. How does Sasana protect us? If you look at the Sasana is the religion, the monks, the nuns. If you look after the monks, then we live a long time. So, you have the monks to come and teach you Dhamma, to inspire you and to lead you. So if you look after the monks will look after you. That makes sense? If you try and squeeze every last bit of juice out of the monks when they're here, then you'll find you're not looking after the sasana. And when you don't look after the monks, there'll be no monks left. There'll be no nuns left. They will hear, oh, in Penang, they work you so hard. Oh, we never want to go back to Penang again. Oh, they don't look after you there. But if you look after the sasana, if you look after the monks, then the monks will look after you. But you have to know how to look after the monks. If you give the monks lots of money, then when they become rich, they're going to disrobe. If you give monks lots of televisions, then they're going to see all these movies of young girls, and they're going to disrobe. If you give monks too much, then they're going to be no different than lay people, so they live like lay people. You have to know how to look after those monks and those nuns. Know what is appropriate to give and what is not appropriate to give. That's looking after them. Do not give them things which will destroy their monastic life. So you should know what the monks' rules are. certain things like televisions, radios, CD players, play music that is, anything which you know is inappropriate for a monk, you should not give them. That's not looking after the monkhood. But sometimes people in Thailand, they complain about the monks. The monks smoke, but then people give them the cigarettes. The monks spend all their time watching television, but then the people offer them television sets. You should be careful what you offer, what you give to monks. That's how you look after the sasana, look after the religion. But also, not just looking after the monks, that's only part. Look after the Buddha, look after the Dhamma. To learn these teachings, the best way of looking after monks is to know yourself what Buddhism is, to know what the rules are, to study, to learn. When everybody knows exactly what a monk should do, what they shouldn't do, they know what the Dhamma is, what the Dhamma isn't, then you can never be conned, you can never be tricked by unscrupulous either monks or lay people. So please learn. Purify your deeds. Sorry, purify your mind. Don't do anything good. Don't do anything good. I'm getting tired. Do what is good. Don't do anything which is bad. Purify the mind. And that's how you look after the sasana. And that's how the sasana protects you. The sasana means the teachings, the instructions. Is there any karmic effect on the hell wardens after they perform their duty of hell wardens? Yeah, there is. Oops. Just getting comfortable again. Some years ago, there was one of the officers of the King of Thailand came to see Ajahn Chah. His job was to sign the death warrants for people who were adjudged to have done capital crimes and were given the death penalty by the judges. The judges would give the death penalty, but he had to sign off on the death warrant on behalf of the king. And he came to see Ajahn Chah and he says, "Is this bad karma? Should I be doing this?" And he said, "No, you shouldn't be doing this." "Well, someone's got to do it," he complained. "Well, let someone else do it." "You don't have to do it." That was Ajahn Chah's advice. The wardens of hell, like the wardens of jails, that's called bad karma, bad livelihood, wrong livelihood in Buddhism, being a jail warder, especially if that jail warder has a job of torturing, you know, punishing, beating, or even killing. That's called wrong livelihood. So in this world, it's wrong livelihood. In other worlds, it would be wrong livelihood as well. I remember that monk, Dhammabhutto, he said that one day the public executioner of Malaysia visited him. The one who actually hangs people. And he said, even as a monk, even he was scared in the presence of this person who pulled the lever to hang people. He said it was terrifying being around this person. His aura, his presence, was very, very uncomfortable. Even though it's a job, it is still bad karma. After a certain period of practice, we may develop some... Oh, no, I've done this one already. Already done. Oops. That's already gone, never mind. Is there any karmic effect to the hell wardens? Yes, it's all done. Finished. I've got some other questions here which I'll do tomorrow, but it's 10 o'clock. And I do not want to be a warden of hell by making you suffer any further. You've been sitting here for a long period listening to the Dhamma. You've been making some good karma. If we give a Dhamma talk which is too long, you get what is called Dhamma indigestion. And I don't want you to go away with Dhamma indigestion, which means you've heard too much. So thank you for coming this evening. It is now just past 10:05. We talked about karma tonight. Tomorrow is a talk about, what was it again? Why stop? That's letting go. Why not? This is letting go. This is making the best karma of all, being free like a bird. So tomorrow it's called letting go. Please bring all your friends, and more importantly, bring your enemies as well. They also need to learn the Dhamma. Thank you very much for coming this evening. Okay, announcements, give the sharing of blessings, sharing of merits first. Okay, do the sharing of merits before people go. Idang me.
Idang me nyatinang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idang me nyatinang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam men yatinam hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.